This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو منه من قرآن ولا تعملون من عمل إلا كنا عليكم شهودا إلا كنا عليكم شهودا إذ تفيضون فيه وما يعزب عن ربك من قال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثل قال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's foreign minister arrives in Oman to deliver a message from President Ibrahim Raisi, discuss bilateral and international developments with top Omani officials. Russia's foreign minister accuses unnamed U.S. officials of threatening to physically eliminate President Vladimir Putin. And a new report shows more than 6,000 children have been killed or hurt by gunfire in the U.S. in 2022. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister is in Oman on an official visit to discuss major regional and international developments with high-ranking officials there. Upon arrival in Muscat, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said he's carrying a message from President Ibrahim Raisi to Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq. The top diplomat also said his visit is an opportunity for both countries to discuss bilateral relations. Amir Abdullahian added the ongoing crises in Yemen, Afghanistan, and Ukraine the main topic of discussions in his meetings with Omani officials. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has blasted the Western states for their anti-Iran propaganda as well as hypocrisy regarding the recent riots in the Islamic Republic. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. This is what they had to say.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has blasted Western hypocrisy as regards the recent riots in the Islamic Republic. He says that the West promoted propaganda that portrayed Iran on the decline. He, however, said that Western powers also sent messages that they did not seek subversion in the country, and they're ready to resume talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. The president also says the riots were a multifaceted war on Iran, including by such powers as the U.S. and anti-Iran groups as MKO terrorists. Raisi also warned against attempts to undermine Iran's national solidarity. He says any such move will be in line with the enemy's strategy of undermining Iran's independence. Right, to discuss this, I'm joined by a couple of guests. Let me invite Fuad Izzati, professor at the University of Tehran. Also with me is Marcus Papadopoulos, who's a historian, political analyst, and author, joining us from London. Good to see you, gentlemen, both. Now, Professor Izzati, what is it exactly that authorities in the West want Iran to do? They want to revive the JCPOA, that's what they're saying. At the same time, they are openly supporting riots in Iran and even teaching them what to do, how to attack security forces and all that, and those, you know, as Persian speaking, London-based TV channels operating as war rooms, and the West is just encouraging them, maybe, and even in some cases, funding them instead of stopping them. So what is it exactly that they want to do?
Well, they want to overthrow the Iranian government. They have been trying to do that for the last 43 years. And the argument they are making in practice is that while we are working on overthrowing government, let's have talks to make sure that you don't have a nuclear program. That's the basic idea. And even for the talks, they drag their feet. And the reason they do that is that there's this contradiction that if you want to overthrow the government, And then you want to have an agreement. Iran would not sign an agreement unless the sanctions are lifted or suspended. Then that would result in less sanctions on Iran, which is counterproductive to the idea of overthrowing the government. That's why there is this level of confusion in the West. You know, I think what Iran has done in the last 42 years is to develop this culture of resistance. So you resist these pressures that is coming from the West. That's the number one thing you do. And the second thing you do is to make sure that there is a level of popular support. And the third thing that Iran has done is to not leave this negotiating table. Because if you do that, then the other side would engage in this blame game that we wanted to reach an agreement and Iran is refusing.
Marcus, we have 1 minute left. Let me know if you agree with Professor Izzetti.
Yes, I do. Ultimately, the West, principally America and Britain, seeks to overthrow the Iranian government, seeks the destruction of the Iranian revolution, and seeks to re-establish Western direct rule in Iran. How Iran was ruled under the Shah prior to the Iranian revolution. However, the West projects itself to the rest of the world as the defender of democracy, as the defender of international law. Therefore, the West, on the one hand, in public, has to be seen as seeking a diplomatic compromise with the Iranian government concerning, for example, the JCPOA. But on the other hand, in private, through subversion, the West is using various means at its disposal to not just weaken Iran, not just to try and weaken the Iranian economy, but also to vilify, to demonize Iran, the Iranian leadership, and the Iranian people. And naturally, the Western ruling elites do so via Western mainstream media. Western mainstream journalists are purveyors of deceit. They are peddlers of falsehoods, and they are spreaders of disinformation. Western mainstream media is neither free nor independent. Therefore, it is only inevitable that Western mainstream media will be employed by the Western ruling elite to project Iran to the rest of the world as a economic wasteland, as a land of tyranny, and as a land of savages. And then Western politicians in public attempt to distance themselves on occasions from what Western mainstream media is doing. So in short, it is an act by the West. Whatever the West says in public about Iran, we can dismiss entirely. It is what the West is doing in private through subversion, which reveals the true intentions, the true nature of the Western ruling elite when it comes to Iran. If the Iranian government was not to enter into these farcical discussions with Western governments, then Western mainstream media would project the Iranian government to the rest of the world as not being interested in seeking compromises, as not being interested in seeking diplomatic solutions. So the Iranian government, alas, has very little choice but to enter into these discussions. Even though these discussions are farcical, they are a complete and utter waste of time. The Iranian government has to play the game. But at the same time, the Iranian government and the Iranian people as a whole need to simply do what they have done since the Iranian revolution of 42 years ago. Focus on Iran, focus on the Iranian economy, and focus on the welfare of the Iranian people.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and insight. Fadi Zadi in Tehran, Marcus Papadopoulos in London.
Elsewhere, Syria says all foreign occupation troops will soon be expelled from the country through the resistance of its people and popular forces. The Syrian Foreign Ministry said people in the northeastern part of the country continue their struggle against foreign forces topped by U.S. occupying troops. It said the expulsion of foreign troops and liberation of the entire Syrian territory is quite imminent. The U.S. military has for years stationed its forces and equipment in northeastern Syria. The Pentagon claims the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the rest of area from falling into the hands of Daesh Takfiri terrorists. But Damascus says the deployment is designed to plunder Syria's rich natural resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil wealth. Damascus says U.S. occupation has cost Syria over $107 billion in oil and gas sector losses. Lebanon's economic and financial crisis remains intact while the political elite have failed to implement reforms or even elect a new president. Some analysts, however, believe there is still hope that the materialization of the natural resources extraction could somehow bring the country out of the current economic impasse. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year, with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, a caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms. As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Russia's foreign minister accuses some U.S. officials of threatening to kill President Vladimir Putin amid escalating tensions between the two nuclear-armed powers. Sergei Lavrov said unnamed officials from the Pentagon have threatened to deliver what he called a decapitating strike on the Kremlin. He added that the remark was a threat to physically eliminate Russia's head of state. He also warned Washington against possible consequences of such plans. Previously, U.S. media reported that Washington would consider a strike on the Kremlin if Moscow uses nuclear weapons. President Joe Biden has also warned the world would face, quote, Armageddon if Putin uses nukes in Ukraine, but the White House says the administration is not seeking to overthrow Putin. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree that bans oil sales to the countries, imposing a price cap on Russian oil. Under the presidential order, any supply of Russian oil and oil products to foreign legal entities and individuals will be prohibited if the contracts for these supplies are using a price cap. The ban will come into force from February the 1st and will last for 5 months. The move comes as energy markets remain volatile due to Western sanctions on Moscow over its war in Ukraine. The EU, the Group of Seven Developed Economies, and Australia reached an agreement on enforcing a ceiling of $60 per barrel on Russian oil in early December. Russia is the world's second largest crude exporter, is firmly opposed to any price cap, warning that such an approach interferes in market pricing process. We've asked independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow about his prediction of the future oil market after Russia's decision to restrict its sales. Here's what he had to say.
I would like to bring up a remark by Dmitry Medvedev, the former president and present of one of the close assistants to President Putin in the Russian government. Medvedev said yesterday that it's possible to anticipate a spike in oil prices during 2023 to the level of $150 per barrel. Now, that is a speculation, of course, but it is based on the realities of the marketplace when Russian oil or another major supplier of oil is taken off the market. Because Russia is denying sales to the countries, and these are G7 countries and all of the European Union, who impose a price cap, means that Russian exports will probably decline, and Russia is prepared, as said as much, they are prepared to cut their production accordingly. So as Russian production and Russian export of oil falls, the market price for oil likely will go up.
Gun violence in the United States is back in the headlines, as a nonprofit group says more than 6,000 children were killed or injured by gunfire in 2022. The Gun Violence Archive says the figure is the largest ever recorded in a single year in its nine-year history of tracking shootings. It says over 300 of the victims were 11 years old or younger. The figure comes against the backdrop of the killing of a three-year-old girl on Christmas Eve in Kansas City in what police said was an accidental shooting. Last week, another study showed young black people in the U.S. are disproportionately impacted by gun violence. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has unveiled new goals for the country's military for 2023 at a meeting of the ruling Workers' Party. Kim reviewed the newly created challenging situation on the Korean Peninsula and the border political landscapes. The North Korean leader set the direction for what he called anti-enemy struggle and goals for reinforcing defense power. Kim specified the principles of foreign affairs to protect sovereign rights and defend national interests. Tensions have remained high on the Korean Peninsula this year. That's because of North Korea's repeated missile launches as well as joint military drills by the neighboring South, and the U.S. Pyongyang sees the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion. The other side is opposed to the North's missile tests. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
6 in 10 adults in the UK surveyed said they were planning on cutting spending in the holiday period by buying fewer and less expensive presents and eating out less, the Office for National Statistics said recently. Household incomes are being hit by the biggest jump in prices in four decades. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, energy bills, rent, and mortgage payments are the most commonly reported financial burdens in the UK. Consumers in the UK have slashed spending on Christmas gifts this year as household incomes across the country have suffered amid the biggest jump in prices in 40 years. Bloomberg reported recently, citing a survey published by the Office for National Statistics, ONS. 6 in 10 adults surveyed admitted they were planning to cut the amount they spend during this festive season by buying fewer and less expensive presents. Meanwhile, British charities have reported booming sales as cash-strapped shoppers are looking for second-hand Christmas gifts. With disposable income hit by skyrocketing inflation, people are tightening their belts and expect to eat out and socialize less, the Public Opinion and Social Trends survey showed. Inflation in the UK reached 11.1% in October, more than five times the Bank of England's 2% target.
About 18% of respondents told the ONS they had no savings to shield themselves from surging costs, and 7% reported they had missed a bill payment in the past month. Households were facing the highest financial pressure from energy bills, as well as mortgage and rent payments, the ONS said. Nearly half of UK adults reported they were hardly able to heat their homes, and three-quarters were alarmed about the cost of living. Bloomberg also reported British consumers have cut back on Christmas gift giving after the tightest cost of living squeeze in memory reduced disposable income. Official figures showed 6 in 10 adults in the UK surveyed said they were planning on cutting spending in holiday period by buying fewer and less expensive presents and eating out less, the Office for National Statistics said recently. The Press United also wrote in this regard, consumers in the UK have slashed the spending on Christmas gifts this year as household incomes across the UK have suffered amid the biggest jump in prices in 40 years. Meanwhile, British charities have reported booming sales as cash-strapped shoppers are looking for second-hand Christmas gifts. With disposable income hit by skyrocketing inflation, people are tightening their belts and expect to eat out and socialize less. About 18% of respondents told ONS they had no savings to shield themselves from surging costs, and 7% reported they had missed a bill payment in the past month. Households were facing the highest financial pressure from energy bills, as well as mortgage and rent payments. Nearly half of UK adults reported they were hardly able to heat their homes, and three-quarters were alarmed about the cost of living. Also, Guardian reported Britain's recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic has been even weaker than originally believed and is the only member of the G7 group of leading industrial countries where output is still below its pre-crisis level. The Office for National Statistics said the UK economy contracted by 0.3% in the 3 months to September, compared with an original estimate of a 0.2% decline. The ONS also revised down growth in every quarter, stretching back to the third quarter of 2021. As a result, the UK's gross domestic product is now estimated to be 0.8% lower in the third quarter of 2022 than in the final 3 months of 2019, the period immediately before the start of the disruption caused by COVID. Previously, the ONS had estimated the UK was operating 0.4% below its pre-pandemic level, and according to the latest data, it is now the only G7 country that has yet to recover ground lost when the global economy was locked down in 2020. Of the other G7 members, GDP is 4.3% above levels in late 2019 in the US and higher by 2.7% in Canada, 1.8% in Italy, 1.1% in France, 0.9% in Japan, and 0.3% in Germany. Gabriella Dickens, UK analyst at Pantheon Macro, said the UK's underperformance largely reflected weakness in households' real spending, which was 3.2% lower in the third quarter of 2022 than in the final 3 months of 2019, compared with an average increase of 1.6% across the other G7 economies. Dickens said households' spending has been relatively subdued in Britain due to the comparatively muted recovery in employment, larger price increases, and the fact that households in Britain have been less willing to reduce their saving rate than those overseas.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saudi Arabia in the world of politics.
Part 2.
In recent years, Saudi Arabia has been the largest buyer of arms in the world and is making great efforts to continue on this path. At the same time, it is trying to start a coalition of its friends, especially the Arab countries, against Iran.
Talk is cheap. Let's look at the actions. Saudis helped Saddam Hussein for 8 years. Saudis helped Al-Qaeda. Saudis created Daesh. Saudis created a Nusra. So they started this sectarian message, not us.
Nonsense. The Iranians are the ones who are exporting terrorism. They're the ones who are stoking the fires of sectarianism. They're the ones who are violating international laws and norms and acceptable behavior. And they're the ones who have been on an aggressive path since 1979.
Despite the fact that the United States and almost every other powerful nation supports Saudi Arabia actively and tries to undermine us actively, we are still the most influential power in the Middle East. That should tell you something. That should tell you that we have made the right choices and they've made the wrong choices.
The end of World War I was an era of reform in the world of politics. It was no longer like the days before the war, and the following years were the beginning of a new era for geographical maps. New rulers, one after another, could find their place in the world of politics. In Iran, it was Reza Shah's turn. A few years later, on the anniversary of Reza Shah's reign, Saudi King Abdul Aziz bin Saud sent him a congratulatory message. In response, on July 1st of 1928, Habibullah Hoveida was sent to Hejaz as Iran's representative so that Iran could officially begin its ties with the Saudi dynasty. During the years after these negotiations, the most important issue between the two countries was performing the Hajj and organizing the sending of Iranian pilgrims to Hejaz. It continued until 1944, when a young man named Abu Talib Yazdi and his wife decided to travel to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. During the Tawaf, this 22-year-old man got sick in the heat of the sun and vomited. Urged by some pilgrims, Saudi officers accused him of vomiting deliberately. Abu Talib was arrested and the judge sentenced him with beheading. The sentence was carried out in public. As the bitter news of Yazdi's beheading reached Iran, a wave of protest began in the country. On January the 18th of 1944, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran issued a statement and sent a letter to Saudi Arabia condemning this act. In the following days, many articles condemning this act and asking the government to protest Saudi Arabia were published in newspapers. Iran did not find the Saudi government's response to the incident convincing and sent another letter of protest to Saudi Arabia on February the 7th. The lack of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia continued in the next 5 years until King Abdul Aziz sent a letter to Iranian King Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on the subject of cooperation of Islamic nations. In the letter, he also expressed his desire to establish relations between the two countries. Following these letters and with the sending of ambassadors, political relations resumed in 1948 and the issue of Hajj was on the agenda. The Saudi embassy in Tehran announced that it would do its utmost to ensure the security of Iranian pilgrims. In 1958, General Abdul Karim Qasim staged a coup in Iraq. It resulted in overthrowing the monarchy and establishing a republic in the country, a coup that worried both the monarchies of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Qasim was the first head of government in Iraq who claimed that the two Iranian cities of Khorramshahr and Abadan belonged to Iraq. His government also had a clear interest in the Soviet Union. These positions were good reasons for Iran and Saudi Arabia to become closer to one another and become enemies of Iraq. In 1964, King Saud, the second king of Saudi Arabia, died at the age of 67, and his crown prince, King Faisal, came to power. The new king of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran on his first foreign trip in 1964. Following this visit, the Iran-Saudi Arabia Friendship Association was founded under the chairmanship of the then Prime Minister of Iran, Amir Abbas Hoveida, and bilateral relations expanded from the political and economic spheres to scientific and cultural issues. A few years later, in 1973, Saudi students received scholarships in some fields, including law and medicine in Iran, as Tehran signed a contract to establish a medical college in Riyadh. Oil has always played a decisive role in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. But one of the most important turning points in this story is the Yom Kippur War between Egypt and Israel in 1973, which led to an oil shock back then. Through Saudi Arabia, the U.S. tried to force Iran to reduce oil prices, and in this regard, contacts and meetings were held between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but neither of them decreased oil prices. In contrast, to satisfy the Americans, Saudi Arabia increased its oil production from 8.3 to 10 million barrels per day. The increase in production, which eventually led to a drop in oil prices, made the Iranian king criticize Saudi Arabia. King Faisal was assassinated by one of the Saudi princes on April the 1st of 1975. This worried all the allies of the Saudi family, especially the King of Iran. Almost a month later, in May of 1975, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi visited the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Khalid, to indicate the relations with that country were important to him. But no one knew that it was the last visit of the Pahlavi king to Saudi Arabia, and the next victim of the world of politics would be him. The Islamic Revolution in Iran changed all equations in the region, and Iran's relationship with Saudi Arabia was an important part of this transformation. Now, there was no sign of a two-columns coalition between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the region, and whatever used to be a matter of closeness between the two countries became a factor of distance.
The people were in a frenzy to catch just a glimpse of the man they revere like a god. They clawed and clambered and ran to see and be near him for 15 miles. And no more than a tiny fraction of the multitude succeeded.
The initial reaction of the Saudi officials to the victory of the Islamic Revolution can be called a conservative one. King Khalid, in his first reaction, called the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran a prelude to greater rapprochement and understanding between the two countries. 3 months after the victory of the revolution in April of 1979, a Saudi delegation traveled to Iran. In a meeting with Iran's Imam Khomeini, the leader emphasized the role of Islam in the victory of Muslims, emphasized Islamic unity, reminded of the danger of Israel, and expressed hope that the Saudis' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims would improve. On November the 21st of 1979, an event took place in Mecca that shocked the Islamic world. While the Imam of Masjid al-Haram was preparing for the morning congressional prayer, a group led by Juhayman al-Otaibi entered the Masjid al-Haram and killed several officers. The rebels were members of the Salafist community and were staunch opponents of the Saudi monarchy. After the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, the New York Times was just one of American media outlets which linked the occupiers to Iran. But the next day, Interior Minister Prince Nayef issued a statement stressing the reports that Iran is involved in this matter are completely false and baseless. Finally, after 2 weeks of fighting, with the help of French forces sent to Saudi Arabia, the occupiers of Masjid al-Haram were arrested and 62 members of the group were executed, along with Juhayman. Simultaneously with the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, an unforeseen event in the eastern region of Saudi Arabia made the Saudi rulers angry with Iran. Shias in this area marched on the day of Ashura, demanding their civil rights while they were holding pictures of Imam Khomeini. The Saudi rulers, who were still involved in the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, reacted harshly to the incident, which resulted in 24 deaths on the day of Ashura in 1979. In an interview in January of 1980, the new U.S. President Ronald Reagan stated, "We will not allow Saudi Arabia to become another Iran and fall into the hands of those who want to cut off the vital flow of oil to the West." The liberation of the Iranian city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces on May the 24th of 1982 is an important milestone in the Ba'athist regime's imposed war against Iran. This upset all the equations of Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein and his supporters, including Saudi Arabia. When Iran achieved success in the war, it led to unprecedented Saudi financial aids to Saddam. According to official reports, Saudi Arabia provided more than $60 billion to Saddam during the war, and this kind of support continued until the end of the war. In June of 1985, the Saudi foreign minister visited the Islamic Republic of Iran for the first time. Saud al-Faisal's agenda was to improve the ties between the two countries and to encourage Iran to conduct peace negotiations with Iraq. In the same year, Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Velayati also visited Saudi Arabia. It did not bring much development in the relations between the two countries, but reduced the spread of tension. But among the events between the two countries, the Hajj of 1987 is one of the bitterest days in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. The Saudi security forces' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims dates back to the disavowal of polytheists in Hajj in the post-revolutionary years. It is annoying for the Saudi authorities to hear the slogans "Death to America" and "Death to Israel," particularly because the U.S. is the main ally of the Saudis. During the Hajj of 1987, more than 400 pilgrims were martyred, 323 of whom were Iranians. Of course, this is a statistic announced by Saudi officials. After this massacre, the Saudi officials said that the reason for this behavior towards Iranian pilgrims was their decision to capture Masjid al-Haram and moved the Kaaba to Qom in Iran. Finally, on April the 26th of 1987, Saudi Arabia severed political ties with Iran. Shortly after the end of the Iraq-Iran war, Arab countries demanded repayment of the money they had given to Saddam during the war, and Kuwait was at the forefront of these creditors. Iraq's Ba'athist regime, which considered itself to be the representative of the Arab world against Iran, refused to repay its debt. Saddam also called for a reduction in oil production by Arab countries so that he could rebuild the ruins of war by raising oil prices, a request that was opposed by Arab countries, especially Kuwait. The continuation of tensions led to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd of 1990, an event that shocked the whole world, especially the Arab friends of the Ba'athist regime. The Iraqi army even crossed Kuwait and entered the Saudi city of Al-Khafji. The continuation of this campaign could seriously endanger the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
A U.S.-led coalition of 35 countries quickly formed to oust Saddam's army from Kuwait. Arab countries that thought Iran might side with Saddam welcomed Iran's neutrality, which resulted in the resumption of talks to improve relations with Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia. In the 1990s, a new era of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia began that was unprecedented in the years following the Iranian Revolution. In a meeting in June of 1991, the new president of Iran, Hashemi Rafsanjani, called Iran and Saudi Arabia two wings of the Islamic world. A few months later, officials from the two sides met at the Islamic Unity Conference, and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah invited Hashemi Rafsanjani on a pilgrimage. In the winter of 1998, an important event took place in Tehran. The 8th Summit of Islamic Countries began in the Iranian capital on December the 7th with the participation of the vast majority of heads of Islamic countries and high-ranking officials from 55 Muslim nations. Saudi delegation is attending the conference at the highest level. For the first time since the Iranian Revolution, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran to meet senior officials of the Islamic Republic. Relations that had begun in the early 1990s reached their highest level that promised different years ahead. A few months later, an agreement was reached between Tehran and Riyadh in the fields of industrial activities, transportation, environment, sports, and tourism. According to the agreement, the travel ban on citizens in eastern Saudi Arabia, who are mostly Shias, was lifted, and Iran held a trade fair there. After that, direct flights were established from Dammam in Saudi Arabia to Tehran and Mashhad in Iran. The ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia were slowly and cautiously improving in the following years, but an event completely changed the relations in the world of politics. On the morning of September the 11th of 2001, several U.S. airliners changed their predetermined routes and targeted some major centers in different U.S. cities. The world was shocked by this operation, which was somehow like a science fiction movie. Shortly after the attacks, the U.S. administration under President George W. Bush announced its official account. 19 members of Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, were responsible for planning and carrying out the operation. Interestingly, 15 of the perpetrators of this operation were Saudi nationals. Saudi Arabia was in the spotlight of the world media, and the important question was how these people were able to carry out these attacks. The days that followed September the 11th were difficult ones for the rulers of Saudi Arabia.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The United States formed a large coalition to fight terrorism and immediately attacked Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan were among the few countries which had recognized the Taliban in the previous years.
War on terror is not confined strictly to the Al-Qaeda. The war on terror involves Saddam Hussein. Because of the nature of Saddam Hussein, the history of Saddam Hussein, and his willingness to terrorize himself. Saddam Hussein has terrorized his own people. He's terrorized his own neighborhood. He is a danger.
Shortly after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, its war machine shifted to Iraq. With the U.S.-led coalition attack, the Ba'athist regime, controlled by Saddam Hussein, was overthrown, something that had not happened even after the invasion of Kuwait. Now, Saudi Arabia felt that it had lost the game to Iran in two fronts.
This was central Baghdad today, as Saddam Hussein's regime finally lost control.
The statue of Saddam Hussein.
Iran had important enemies on the other side of both its eastern and western borders that had now fallen, and Saudi Arabia was not pleased with this victory and the change of balance of power by the United States.
We'll be right back.
In the Limelight.
Despite economic woes in the UK, this country has decided to increase its military budget in 2024. And this decision was announced in the British publication The Telegraph. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, £1.5 billion or $1.8 billion budget increase is expected for Britain's military in 2024 to 2025, The Telegraph claims. Amid soaring inflation, the UK is set to boost defence spending in 2024 to 2025, The Telegraph has reported, citing sources familiar with the matter. The Ukraine conflict was among the reasons cited by Britain's Ministry of Defence when justifying the spending increase to the Treasury, the paper reported. The decision had already been made in principle, though final figures are expected by spring 2023 when Chancellor Jeremy Hunt may officially announce the increase, the paper adds. The British government is seeking to ensure that the defence budget does not fall relative to inflation, according to The Telegraph. We will avoid a real-term cut in defence budget, an anonymous senior government source confirmed to the paper. While former Prime Minister Boris Johnson did launch a major military investment program back in 2020, the biggest since the end of the Cold War, Britain's defence budget is still projected to fall in real terms between 2022 and 2024 due to soaring inflation, the article noted. Professor Malcolm Chalmers, Deputy Director General of the Royal United Services Institute military think tank, told the outlet that the defence budget would have to rise from £48.6 billion to £50.1 billion, that is $60 billion in 2024, to reach the government's goal. That would translate to at least £1.5 billion, that is $1.8 billion in expected additional investment. The Treasury's reported acquiescence may be down to geopolitical concerns raised by the British government, particularly in light of Russia's military campaign in Ukraine, the article noted. Since late February, when the conflict broke out, London has been one of Kiev's staunchest backers, providing it with weapons and military training. Back in September, the UK government pledged to spend as much or even more than it did in 2022 on military aid to Ukraine next year. According to the press release, Britain was the second largest military donor to Kyiv, having committed some £2.3 billion, that is $2.8 billion, by that time. Russia has in turn consistently condemned Western weapons deliveries to Ukraine, claiming these only serve to prolong the conflict. Moscow has also repeatedly warned that NATO member states are getting increasingly involved in the conflict, which could potentially lead to a direct military confrontation with Moscow. Meanwhile, the Daily Star wrote, 2 years after Britain's departure from the European Union, bosses of UK businesses are reeling from cost of Brexit, including some who voted to cut ties with Brussels. It's cost with no benefit, noted Adrian Hanrahan, chief executive of a small chemicals company, Robinson Brothers, based in central England and for which the EU remains a key market. The problem is not the customs duties, largely eliminated by the post-Brexit free trade agreement between London and Brussels, but rather a mountain of new regulatory paperwork. We've added probably 25% extra now on our administration cost just to cope with the changing paperwork of getting stuff in the form and in from the EU and out of the EU, Hanrahan told AFP. The company employs 265 people producing chemicals used by various sectors featuring food, electronics, pharmaceutical and other firms. Robinson Brothers exports around 70% of its products, of which more than half go to EU. The company is far from alone in struggling with the consequences of Brexit, with 56% of UK businesses facing difficulties adapting to new trading rules